Thank you. Be seated.
Court is ready to hear argument from petitioner in Kerrville State Hospital versus Clark.
May it please the court. David Allen Smith will present arguments for petitioner. Petitioner has reserved 10 minutes for rebuttal.
May it please the court. I intend to direct my prepared remarks this morning to three different areas of issues raised by this appeal. First relates to the question of duty. Second relates to whether Kerrville State Hospital's alleged negligence involved the use of tangible property, as that term is defined under the Texas Tort Claims Act. And third, even if there was such a use, whether that use was shown to be a proximate cause of Rebecca Liggins' death. To my knowledge, this court has never before held a physician, a psychiatrist, or a hospital liable to someone other than his or her patient for decisions made during the treatment of that patient. In fact, the last time that this court considered the issue in Byrd versus WCW, it held that as a matter of law, there is no professional duty running from a psychiatrist to a third party to not negligently treat a patient. I believe this court is being asked in this case to create a new common law duty in the state of Texas, one that would be owed to someone other than the patient. In Graff versus Beard, this court set out the things that should be looked at when creating a new common law duty. This court described the process as one involving complex policy questions that include the foreseeability of the risk at issue, the social utility of the potential defendant's conduct, the magnitude and the consequences of placing the burden of the new duty on that potential defendant. In attempting myself to get a handle on what these policy considerations might be in reaching a decision about whether Texas is to create such a duty, I had the opportunity to look at approximately 60 law review articles. It seems that the other jurisdictions, the other states, are kind of all over the place on this issue. I'm sure the court's aware of the case of Tarasoff versus the Board of Regents of the University of California, the case that is often cited for the concept of duty to warn if there's a specific threat as to an identifiable victim. Well, the other states have reached conclusions on a spectrum that range from there being no duty owed to third persons to as broad a duty as that being simply reasonable care. What the psychiatric profession feels about this is that psychiatry is an inexact science. This court has so stated in Byrd. The United States Supreme Court has so stated, pointing out that psychiatrists disagree wildly and frequently. In looking at the commentators, it is this inexactness that seems to lead those states that have not been willing to adopt this kind of duty to say that they will not. And in fact, one court, an intermediate court of appeals in Florida, has flatly rejected any kind of imposition of duty owed to a third party, a person other than the patient, based on the fact that psychiatry is an inexact science.
There's nothing inexact under the facts of these cases. Man was a known, violent individual who was potentially suicidal and or homicidal. Isn't that right?
I would not agree with that. I believe what the record suggests is that in April, May, and July of 1989, when the order of commitment was issued, that he was undergoing an acute psychotic episode. He had an antisocial personality and was suffering from bipolar syndrome. I think the record also shows that fairly quickly that acute psychotic episode was brought under control.
So when some of the records say that this is where Dr. Beal, for example, says this is the most dangerous patient seen in a psychiatric practice, private or state, he's manic, alcoholic and or drug addict, who knows martial arts, which he knows is his ex-military, he's potentially suicidal and or homicidal. I mean, this is not a case where the psychiatrist, the physician, failed to diagnose. This is one where there's a known danger, isn't it?
Well, if I understand your question, yeah, this is not a failure to diagnose. This is a patient who was diagnosed as having mental illness, and at least when that affidavit was signed in July of 89, and of course we're talking about here, decisions made almost a year later that give rise to this lawsuit, that he was suspected of being a dangerous person.
Let me go back to what you said a minute ago about other states. You talk about Florida. You say they range all the way from no duty to reasonable foreseeability. And you mention a Florida intermediate court that has held no duty. Are there any other courts in other states?
I think Iowa, at this point, has declined to adopt Tarasoff as well.
You don't mention these cases in your brief, could you?
No, I don't. Yeah.
Could you help us out with a post-submission letter?
Yes, Your Honor, I'd be pleased to.
Counsel, you mentioned Graff. Is it your position that the Kerrville State Hospital had no right of control whatsoever?
They had a limited right of control, I believe, based on the outpatient commitment order.
Could you expand on that? What was that right of control?
Well, they had been ordered by the county judge to treat Mr. Ligon. He had been placed pursuant to that order in their custody, but the county judge had directed that the custody be on an outpatient basis, meaning he would not be kept by the judge's order in the hospital facility. The judge ordered that he would be treated by Kerrville State Hospital, but outside the facility. And the treatment would take the form of monitoring, an outreach program, more than anything else.
And that limited right of control would not have prevented this result under any set of circumstances. Is that your contention?
That is what I believe, Your Honor.
Did the hospital have an obligation to seek commitment?
I believe if Mr. Ligon had presented with symptoms or a condition or recurrence of the psychosis that suggested he met the civil commitment standard, then the hospital should have sought in-house commitment. But I believe the record suggests that at the point of time in May of 1990, when he came in voluntarily for the 3 or 4 days, that he did not meet that standard. And without such a standard, our mental health code, as well as decisions of the United States Supreme Court, hold that a person cannot be deprived of their liberty. So had he met the standard, the hospital could have and probably should have sought commitment, but he did not, according to the evidence introduced at trial.
But you're arguing even if he had met the standard, he should have been in the hospital, and the doctor and the hospital didn't put him in the hospital, they still have no liability, anybody that he might injure. I mean,
Well, in this case, part of my argument hinges on the fact that Kerrville State Hospital is a unit of government. And as a unit of government, the treatment decision, the decision to seek further commitment or not, would have to involve the use of tangible
property. I'm sorry, I used the word hospital, but I'm really talking about the professional duty of the doctor to the patient. That's what I'm really talking about. Even if they had noticed how violent this person was, and even if they said this person ought to be locked up, they choose not to lock him up for whatever reason, they're still not liable to any damage that he causes to a third party.
I believe that's correct under current Texas law.
Now, it's the hospital, you've got some claims regarding sovereign immunity and that sort of thing.
Yes, Ron. The claims regarding sovereign immunity, of course, is whether or not the plaintiffs have brought themselves within the waiver of sovereign immunity. And, of course, in this case, their complaint relates to the type of medication chosen during at the time of the release in May of 1990, the release that was shortly before the murder. Basically, their complaint is that oral medication, antipsychotic medication, had been prescribed as opposed to an injectable form of medication, the theory being that the injectable form would more readily keep Mr. Ligon medicated.
For how long?
Up to 30 days, I believe the testimony at trial was.
One injection will be valid for 30 days, at least the antisocial, the violent behavior, propensity for violence can be curbed with one injection?
I believe that's what the evidence was. And of course, there's it's not a single domino, it's several dominoes, that the antipsychotic medication is to reduce the symptoms of the psychosis. One of the symptoms of the psychosis, should that be developed, could be violence. And the idea of the antipsychotic medication is to prevent the recurrence of it, or to reduce the symptoms.
In your remaining time, can you address briefly address the argument of venue, why you think the Court of Appeals committed error, if any, on venue?
Yes,
sir.
Chapter 15 of the Civil Practice and Remedies Code points out that errors relating to motions to transfer venue are presumed harmful. They shall be reversible. I think, just to put it very succinctly, what this case illustrates is the potential for a plaintiff, just by pleading a supposed cause of action against one defendant, to hold venue in a county where venue should not be. And I know, as the court's aware, here, one defendant, MHMR, which is centered in Austin, Travis County, was joined initially in the suit. Ultimately, the trial judge found absolutely no merit in that cause of action against MHMR. Yet the motion to transfer venue was overruled based on the presence of MHMR, the allegation that MHMR did something in Travis County. So the bottom line result is, based on allegations against one defendant, ultimately found not to be true, Kerrville State Hospital was not tried in Kerr County, where it is, but was tried here in Travis County.
What should we provide if we were to agree with you on that point?
Pardon me, Your
Honor? What is a standard? What is a rule? What is a principle that you articulate if we were to agree with you on that issue?
Well, the court has told us in the Wilson case, and the statute itself says that venue questions should be decided upon a look at the entire record. And I think that the rule should be that when the record shows that a party may have been joined solely to maintain venue in a county where venue would not otherwise be maintainable, then the remedy should be reversal. They should not be allowed to do that. There's no other way to deter them from that kind of conduct, since rulings on motion to transfer venue are not appealable interlocutorily. If there's no other questions, that's all the prepared comments I have at this time.
Any other questions? Thank you, counsel. The court has made your argument from respondents.
May it please the court, Mr. Randall Reed Richards will present argument for respondents.
Good morning. May it please the court, counsel, I represent the respondents in this case, James and Genevieve Clark. They and members of their family are sitting back here at the back of the courtroom. I filed today 8 exhibits with you from your questions. I think that you have those in front of you and you have looked at them. I would like to make just several comments. I don't want to spend much time on this because I think this evidence is illustrative of the issues of duty and proximate cause that I want to talk to you about this morning. On the first exhibit, the request for voluntary inpatient admission, what is important there is the first sentence where he agrees to submit himself to the custody of the hospital. They have assumed his care affirmatively by this document, and he has agreed to that custody. In the second exhibit, one of the justices has already commented on how dangerous this individual was, as acknowledged by the doctor in April of 1989. All of the following exhibits from his request for admission in May of 1990, all of this knowledge predates that admission, and that's important in this case because it's prior knowledge of the hospital of how dangerous this patient is. In the third exhibit, what is important is in two things. On paragraph 6, that he's likely to cause harm to others, and under the lines there where the doctor can write in, they acknowledge he has been assaulted to his family in the past. And the next exhibit is an exhibit, the statement made by Dr. Schulteis, where he acknowledges this individual can become extremely, the word extremely is underlined, dangerous to self and others if not medication compliant. And in this case, as part of the standard of care, we say that sets the standard of care. And a doctor in Texas, by his own testimony, a defendant doctor can set the standard of care by his testimony. In the next document is another document by Dr. Schulteis, signed in July 18, 1989. This was submitted in support of the outpatient commitment order that was secured by the hospital in August of that year. What is important up under number 6 is he has checked that this patient will, if not treated, continue to suffer severe and abnormal mental, emotional, or physical distress and will continue to experience deterioration of his or her ability to function independently and is unable to make a rational and informed decision as to whether or not to submit to treatment. And this was one of the goals of the outpatient commitment. They had to have a means to control this patient because of his long history of noncompliance to enforce his medication regimen. And that's a very important document.
Do you agree with counsel to the hospital that he did not meet the standards for commitment?
As to the second admission in May of 1990? No, I do not, because in the order, the court ordered outpatient commitment in August of 1989, there is a finding by the court at that time that by clear and convincing evidence, he is a danger to himself or others. And the mechanism, the way that order works, and the law under the Texas Mental Health Code at that time is that these doctors only had to notify the court that he was not complying with his treatment program, he was not taking the medications, that there had been a substantial change in his treatment program. All by law are required to be reported by the person responsible, Mrs. Lois Hudson in this case. Clearly under the evidence, undisputed, that was never done. And so my point is, at any time that those factors existed, noncompliance or substantial change in his treatment, as Dr. Hay, the defense expert, said, they had the hook on this guy. All they had to do was tell the court and they could pull him back into the hospital. We didn't even have to proceed at that point in time to an involuntary commitment. That was a way to control this patient, to enforce his medication regimen.
And that commitment would have been at most for how long?
When he was there in May of 1990?
If they had used the hook to get him back in for being noncompliant, how long could they have maintained his inpatient?
They would have had 96 hours to have had a hearing before the court in which to present that evidence to the court. The court would then have made a determination that he should have stayed in the hospital based upon his noncompliance.
Indefinitely?
The way these work, Your Honor, there would have to be periodic reviews to see if he still met the standard to be involuntarily committed to this hospital.
And procedurally, how does that work? The hospital psychiatrist gets information that this patient is not taking medication. You say there's a hook. How do you activate that hook?
There in the statute, there's a what's called a person responsible. You'll see it in the last document where they, under the order, they appoint Lois Hudson as the person responsible. under the Texas Mental Health Code at that time, it becomes her duty to report to the court noncompliance with his treatment program or any substantial changes in his treatment program.
I assume that's done. What's the next step?
There would be a hearing once they did that to see if he was not complying with this order. The court had already found by clear and convincing evidence he was a danger to self and others. His refusal...
But he's not in the courtroom at that point.
Well, they could hold him for 96 hours to obtain that
hearing. I'm talking about, you know, here's this man that's out there and he's causing all sorts of havoc to the family, and it's reported to the court that he's not taking his medication.
Yes, sir.
Somebody's got to go get him.
Mm-hmm.
Who does?
There's a procedure for emergency detention where they could go to
who
a law.
Who goes and physically gets his body and brings him to court or into the hospital?
A law enforcement officer can be directed to do that.
A law enforcement officer?
Yes, under an emergency detention procedure. The document, Exhibit 173, the importance of that is the acknowledgement that this is a psychotic illness suffered by this patient that cannot be cured. It can only be controlled by proper medication. The next important point is he cannot decide on his own, and that was a problem with Mr. Lee.
Well, what I'm concerned about is sort of the collision that counsel alluded to between the mental health code and the standards of compliance with one's medication and that sort of thing that could be enforced while he is in the hospital, but once he is let out of the hospital, presumably after having become compliant with, you know, takes his medication on time and that sort of thing, and his condition is stabilized, once he is released, is there anything that the hospital can do until they get a report that he is in fact off his medication and that he's violent again and that some other incident requiring his recommitment has occurred?
Well, the scenario here for negligence is two things. One is a negligence for the hospital to have discharged this patient. Was he suitable for discharge at that time? The problem that may exist because of York is that if that's based on looking at the records and so forth, it's more difficult to find negligence, even though a lot of states allow recovery or find a duty for negligent release. The other thing they could have done in measuring negligence, however, is if they release him, what exercise of ordinary care did they undertake to see that he would remain medication compliant? As Dr. Rosenthal testified in this case, he simply could have been given his medications by injection. Under the person responsible, he has to report to her once a month under the treatment program. And at the same time, he could have seen his physician. The physician could have administered the shot. There would have been no question that he had taken his medication. And the evidence, just as the evidence in this case shows, that when he didn't take the medications, he deteriorated into aggressive, violent, assaultive behavior. The evidence also shows that when he was medication compliant, we didn't have these kind of problems.
Why is that non-use of tangible personal property?
Why is that not a use?
Why isn't that non-use of tangible personal property?
Non-use would be if they didn't give him any medications. What they did is they gave him medications, the wrong medications, because those kind of medications were ineffective to treat a patient who was known to be non-compliant, had such a long history of non-compliance with taking his medication.
The medication's the same, whether it's taken orally or by injection.
The form is the question.
That's correct. So why is that not used rather than used?
Because the doctor had a decision to make, a medical decision at that time, as to the proper form of medication to give him. And under the testimony of this case, and under the standard of care testified to by Dr. Rosenthal, the standard of care is medication by injection for non-compliant patients. They used the wrong medication. This is not the case like in Kasten versus Hatley, where the medication was taken away from the patient in the emergency room and wasn't given back to her. They actually gave and used and administered this medication, prescribed this kind of medication for this patient. It was totally ineffective. It was improper and inappropriate for this kind of patient. It was a breach of the standard of care.
The duty you argue for is this. Once a physician or hospital determines or under applicable professional standards should determine that a patient poses a serious danger of violence to others, they then bear a duty to exercise ordinary care to protect the foreseeable victim from that danger.
Yes, sir.
Would that include the fellow who goes into the psychiatrist and says, you know, Doc, I really get mad sometimes. In fact, I get so mad I want to kill somebody. I tell you, the three people that I'm maddest most at are these three people. What duty does that impose on the doctor at that point? Not to let him out of the office or to go immediately to the authorities? What would he do?
The cases, if you go back to the Tarasoff line of cases, talk about reasonable precautions. Again, all of this, the duties that we're advocating under Otis, the restatement, under El Chico, and under Tarasoff are all duties that we say combined with what we would normally do in a medical malpractice case, that his exercise of ordinary care is measured against the applicable professional standards.
But in Otis, they sent him home. Here's a situation where if he wants to leave your office, you have no right to detain him. You can't hold him.
One of the things that this court has done in Graff versus Beard, there's a case that followed that called Syntec Realty versus Siegler, is focus on right of control as one of the factors in determining the existence of the duty. And in this case, that's one of the predominant themes in this case, that they got the outpatient commitment order as a means to control this patient. By the documents I showed you, they recognize he can only be controlled by medications.
But I'm now focusing not just on this case, but on the duty you think should be the law. And what I'm wondering is, how does that duty impact a private psychiatrist who has a patient like I described?
He would be asked to exercise ordinary care. The jury would have determined were the precautions that he took. One, first, were they necessary? And secondly, the ones that he took, were they taken with ordinary care to avoid a foreseeable risk of harm to someone else?
So any time that fellow goes out and does something bad, the doctor might have some exposure.
Well, you're going to have competing expert testimony at trial, I would assume, and the jury's going to have to make a factual determination between those two lines of testimony, and they're going to have to decide, based on what's offered to them, did he act reasonably?
And I take it if the patient were remitted to the emergency room and he'd been in a fight, and while the doctor's showing him up, he says, you know, Doc, if I get a chance, I'm going to do worse to the guy that did this to me than what you see here. Again, if you just turn him loose, he might have some problems.
Again, I guess you would have to look at, and what would be important is recognizing these cases, the factors determine duty is his right to control. In this particular case, in the mental health field context, there is a lot more right of control than might exist in the example that you gave in the emergency room.
He voluntarily admitted himself.
That's correct, and he already is under court order at the same time. You had two factors here. The reason I talked about involuntary admitting himself and pointing out that first document, custody, because I think it's very interesting in Otis that there's a dissent written by Justice McGee, and in that dissent, joined by three other justices, they cite a case called Simler versus Psychiatric Institute. And if you'll look at that case, it's very similar factually to this case. And what they argue, Justice McGee does in the dissent in Otis, is that to come under Section 319, we have to show some type of custodial relationship, an exercise of control, he goes on. And so what I'm saying there, the point I would make, is that the dissent, I would submit, would have followed what we're saying here by the examples that they gave. There's a custody relationship and a measure of control here. And the dissent and Otis would have decided this case. It would have been a unanimous, in my opinion, decision of the court.
What I'm wondering, though, is as between Restatement 319 and the duty that you advocate in the case, take charge, which is the focus of the two, is a very broad concept. You might have taken charge of someone just by admitting them into your office and tried to give them advice.
That would be a factual determination under the circumstances by the jury about whether you took charge and whether you had some legal right, perhaps, based on the testimony, to then take in charge and exercise control over this patient, which does exist in this case.
Ms. Richards, the facts of this case are your concern that the doctors did not go get a commitment order from the court?
No, sir.
Well, let me see if I understand. I thought your argument was that the doctors had the ability to call to the court's attention that the patient who was admittedly an outpatient, not an inpatient, but was an outpatient, to to demonstrate to the court that there was a basis for the court changing its order to require the commitment. Now, am I incorrect?
That's the position advocated by the petitioner that they say we advocate in this case. The point that I make is that you either keep him in the hospital, there's two areas of negligence here, or if you relieve him, you exercise ordinary care to see that there's some reasonable assurance when he leaves that he will comply with his medication regimen.
Without changing that court order, did the doctors have any authority to lock him in his room?
The doctors had the authority, the express authority, by their own testimony at trial, to use their discretion to decide the form and dosage levels of the medications to be prescribed during leaving. In fact, as one example of that, as part of the treatment program, he was prescribed antabuse because he was an alcoholic to keep him from drinking. And Dr. Schulteis discontinued the antabuse in December of 1989 because Gary asked him to. And he did not go to court and seek any change in the treatment program. And his testimony at trial was he had the discretion to do that.
Your position that the doctors had the discretion to lock him in his room?
The doctors had the discretion to hold him for 96 hours under Texas law if Gary came in and said, I want to leave the hospital.
Could they do that before they initiate proceedings in court?
Yes, sir. That is a part of the Texas Mental Health Code on a voluntary admission of a patient in a state hospital, that you have 96 hours when that patient makes a request to leave to hold him if you think he is unsuitable for discharge. And the reason for that is to give you this period of time to go see the court hearing if you feel it's necessary.
And any hospital in the state can do that?
The state hospitals can under the Texas Mental Health Code.
Private hospitals could not.
I'm not sure of that. This hospital could have, and by their own testimony and trial, could have.
And
taken
your out. Argument is that the doctors failed to exercise that power, and they should have.
They should have, or if they exercised their judgment to then have released him, what did they do to ensure he would remain medication compliant? Mm-hmm. Because they knew what would happen if he didn't, by these documents and the other evidence in the record. And what the expert for the plaintiffs testified to is there's no evidence they took any care with respect to this patient. They didn't keep him in the hospital. They didn't give injectable forms of medications. They didn't warn Becky. They didn't warn law enforcement officers. They did nothing. And that's what's particularly egregious about this case.
Surely Becky knew.
There's no evidence that Becky knew he was going to be released.
In fact,
Gary
had
Sure, she didn't have violent. There's no question about
it. But your contention is they should have warned her that he was about to be released.
There's a problem in that, in this case. And the reason is because under the Texas Mental Health Code, there are confidentiality provisions. But they talk about one of the things a therapist can do in Tarasoff is warn a victim, a foreseeable victim. In Texas, we have these confidentiality provisions, which says we're not, as some of the testimony in the trial indicated, may even tell someone else that he's even in the hospital. So then what do? What's the next step that the doctor can do to try to exercise ordinary care? Again, he could keep him in the hospital, or if he could change the form of his medications to ensure medication compliance.
So you're saying they could not argue, they could not warn his wife that he's about to be released?
Under the testimony at trial, the Dr. Hay, in his testimony, the expert for the defense, talked about these confidentiality provisions and the problems of whether you breach those by telling someone else even that he's been admitted to the hospital, much less that he's going to be released.
Would you briefly address the venue question, Paul?
Yes, sir. We believe that your decision in Wilson versus Texas Parks and Wildlife decides this case, that when there are two proper venues, that the plaintiff can choose a venue. I think it's important. You can look at it in the context of this case, that under our venue rules, we only have to prove a prima facie case. We don't have to prove that at the time of the venue hearing that we're going to prevail on the merits. And even though the court can go back, an appellate court, and look at the entire record in the case to determine whether there's probative evidence to support that venue ruling earlier made by the court, that in this case, there was summary judgment. We had a motion for directed verdict. We have objections to the charge and submission of issues of negligence against the department to the jury. We have findings by the jury of negligence against the department, proximate cause. You know, what more prima facie case could we have? And those findings are supported by evidence of the witnesses that testified at trial that the department did not properly implement its own policies and standards. Formulation of policy is not waived from immunity under the Act, but the negligent implementation or enforcement of policy, there can be a basis for negligence.
But the lawsuit was dismissed at the MHMR.
After the complete trial, the judge entered a judgment NOV in favor of the department. In the hearing held in August of 1993, I believe, and it's in the record, she makes no statement, Judge Cooper, why she did that. In the order granting, or in the judgment granting NOV, there is no statement of why she granted the judgment NOV.
I don't recall if the you made that a point of error in the Court of Appeals, whether this was even addressed in the Court of Appeals.
I think there was a question, oral argument. It's in the record, and the point just simply is that it would be speculated. Justice Kidd speaks about that in his opinion.
But you did not allege that Judge Cooper committed error in dismissing MHMR in the Court of Appeals.
We didn't do that because we had a finding of liability against the department, and because of the caps there on damages, it made no sense to try to pursue multiple defendants on appeals and appeal that decision. We would argue that if you were to permit, if you were to require a plaintiff to have shown that he would have prevailed on the merits, where you could look at the entire record at the end of the trial, that this would be a terrible waste of judicial resources and time to actually go through litigation and try the case and then reverse it at the end, if you had a standard like that. And that's why I think the correct standard is that, as enunciated in the rules, Rule 87, is that we only show a prima facie case at the time of the injury. I would like to mention that I already spoke to you that Dr. Rosenthal established a standard of care. He also, there's testimony by Dr. Schulteis, where he states that in Gary's case, he was to consider the type of treatment or course of treatment that would adequately protect against any danger that Gary might have posed to himself or others, that that's a very important consideration. He's setting up a duty for himself. The defense expert, Dr. Hay, talks about that if you're going to discharge him, one of the duties, there was a duty that the staff had at the hospital, is to consider new medication that might be appropriate at the time he was discharged. And that site is in our brief. I don't have much time. I'd like to speak to proximate cause just a moment. Dr. Rosenthal testified in this case that within reasonable medical probability, Gary's condition would deteriorate if he failed to take his Thorazine, that it greatly increased the danger of him being psychotic, that before the discharge, there was already evidence that he was becoming more violent towards his wife, that it was inconceivable that if he was to be treated outside the hospital setting, that the doctors did not use injectable medications, considering how worried they were about this patient. There was a significant risk that he would be violent if he did not take his medications. Dr. Hay, very important point of testimony evidence on page 1960 in the record. The evidence of increased hostility towards his wife is evidence of the deterioration in his mental condition caused by not taking his medications. A reasonably prudent psychiatrist would have known this. Page 1960. Dr. Hay talks about the best predictor of future behavior is past behavior. Dr. Schulteis has shown his foreseeability in the document that I gave you today, that he's extremely dangerous when he does not take his medications. Dr. Hardy, Dr. Schulteis's boss, the clinical director of the hospital, there was above average chance that Gary would relapse into violent behavior if he did not take his medications, page 1504. I think that when you consider the substance of this testimony as a whole, that there can be no other conclusion that the jury could have reasonably come to that has established cause and fact in this case.
Any other questions? Thank you, Jim.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm.
I'd like to address just a couple of points in rebuttal. Whether or not this court concludes that the treatment decisions amount to negligence or not, in terms of the decision to prescribe oral medication as opposed to injectable form of that same medication, that does not end the inquiry in holding Kerrville State Hospital liable. The reason it does not is that, as a unit of government, Kerrville State Hospital must be found to have used, that negligent must relate to a use of tangible personal property.
Or misuse.
Or misuse of tangible personal property. And that use or misuse must be a proximate cause of the harm. So whether or not the court concludes that there was negligence in the treatment decisions, and whether or not this court finds a distinction between these facts and the facts in Kasten versus Hatley, this court must still find that the decision not to use injectable Prolixin was the cause of Rebecca Ligon's death. And the record is devoid of evidence on the scenario that the doctors testified to as a possibility. That is the evidence, there is no evidence that Gary Ligon had subtherapeutic levels of Thorazine in his system, and there is no evidence that in fact, because of that, his psychosis had returned, and there is no evidence to suggest that that psychosis was the cause of the murder. Unfortunately, people murder their spouses often and without a psychosis.
Not like this, though. Just kind of an unusual murder.
I suppose the disposal of the body.
Dismemberment. I mean, the whole scene was off.
Well, if it were the case that those kind of murders did not occur without psychosis, then I guess we would never convict anyone of those kinds of murders, and I think that we do. The second point I'd like to make focuses on Dr. Respondent's assertion that the county judge in this case had found that Gary Ligon was a danger to himself or others. The actual court's order, which I believe, and I cannot call the exhibit number right now, but there is a disjunct in the court's finding. The court, using one of those form orders in civil commitment proceedings, says, and the court finds that the proposed patient is a danger to himself or others, or that his condition is deteriorating and he needs to get treatment. And I don't think that this court can conclude which of the two disjuncts the county judge was finding as the basis for holding that Gary Ligon needed treatment.
Is the finding of danger to himself or to others necessary for a commitment to the hospital setting by the trial court?
No. The trial court can find alternatively that mental disease or defect, I think, the person has to be mentally ill. They must then either be dangerous to themselves or others, or their condition must be deteriorating so that treatment has to be forced on them. It's a disjunct. So a person can be commodified of dangerous to self or others. And I think I would like to stress, since you've been handed exhibits, since those are in the records, since a lot of the language talked about here as to how dangerous Mr. Ligon was or wasn't, again, noting the dates on all those analyses, they date back to July of 1989. The episode at issue here is in May of 1990. Those familiar with the mental health process know how quickly things can change. In fact, that's why we had, I don't know if we still have, a 90-day commitment, because we know that mentally ill people going through these kind of acute episodes can become stabilized in as little as 90 days. And again, stressing, Gary Ligon, yes, they had reported instances of aggressive or violent behavior in 1989. Yes, some doctors, in their efforts to get him into the hospital, get him treated and stabilized, said he could be a danger to himself or others or needed treatment in 1989. But by May of 1990, the evidence is that he had stabilized, that he was no longer in his acute psychotic episode. And
when was the antabuse discontinued?
I believe it was in December of 1989.
So when he was discharged, he was no longer being given it.
And if you mean the release after the voluntary admission in May, yeah, he had not been taking the antabuse, is my understanding of the record. For several months. Yeah.
Counsel, and you said that the evidence was in the 1990 that he was stabilizing, I believe you said. The terms of the court order committing him to the care of Kerrville State Hospital, what was the term of that order? When did that order expire?
It was, the order was for a period of 12 months. I believe it was dated in August of 1989.
August the 11th of 89.
Yes. So the 12-month term would have it expire August the 11th, 1990, after these events. And I think the...
What was the date of the death, the murder?
In late May or early June 1990, which would be before the expiration of that order.
So by the terms of this order, Mr. Lignon was still under the care of the Kerrville State Hospital?
I believe that's correct, John. Yeah. The order states that he would be an inpatient for a couple or 3 days and that thereafter on outpatient. In that regard, John, I'd like to stress on this, when he comes in for a voluntary, I think the hospital has to release him when he requests. Whether they can hold him 96 and do or not, the law is they have to release him when he requests to be released unless he meets the standard for commitment. And in
well,
that
they have an option of holding him 96 hours anyway, don't they?
They could hold him up to 96 hours.
Right. So they don't have to immediately release him when he requests.
That's correct, John. They don't have to immediately release him. It's his right that's being protected there, that if he files, when he admits himself to an hospital, if he files a request to be released, the hospital's got to let him out. Now they've got 96 hours if they think he needs to be committed to get the process going, to get the things done. But they've got to let him out if he doesn't meet the standard. And in this case,
they can't hold him while they're trying to go through the process of getting the commitment.
For that 96 hours, yeah. If he's a voluntary inpatient, they don't have to let him out until that 96 hours is exhausted. But in this case, the record reflects in exhibits introduced by the plaintiffs themselves that the hospital called the county judge and, according to the progress notes, told the county judge what had transpired in that May voluntary admission. And the county judge told them, no, he's going to be back on the outpatient commitment, which would suggest that, strongly suggest, that Gary Ligon didn't meet the civil commitment, the in-house involuntary commitment standard in May of 1990.
Mr. Smith, I don't know the answer to this. Are only state hospitals permitted to retain someone for 96 hours pending a hearing on commitment?
I don't know the answer to that either.
If Kasson, some of the issues in Kasson were brought forward, that is, the function is the same function that private medical providers can provide in trying to determine the issues of sovereign immunity or not, would it be significant that only state hospitals have the authority to retain someone for 96 hours pending a commitment hearing, as opposed to a private hospital holding someone for 96 hours pending a commitment hearing? Would that be have any relevance on this?
Perhaps. If the duty is defined in actions that the health care provider must take, then I don't think it would matter if this court imposes a duty, whether ultimately the patient ends up in their hospital or somewhere else. The duty is that the professional who is observing the patient and is going to exercise professional judgment sees enough to suggest that that patient should be taken into custody to protect himself or others or whatever, then I don't think it matters whether the custody is going to be in that practitioner's hospital or someone else's.
Did he return to the hospital after death? Was he recommitted to the hospital?
I don't know whether he ended up in Kerrville State Hospital. He has ended up in Vernon State Hospital, I believe, in connection with the criminal charges that were filed.
Any other questions? Thank you, counsel. That concludes the third argument, and the court will take another brief recess.
The audience, please rise.